Hello, everyone. This is Steve with the Would Somebody Testify podcast. Today, I have with me Brother Juan Lopez. Greetings.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
Good to have you. So for those of you who do not know him, Brother Juan Lopez is, as you can guess, Hispanic. He actually was born in Mexico, moved up to here in the States. Long story short, he eventually came to the Raging Sage Church and got saved. So that's what he's here to talk about today.
All right. All right. Well, thanks again for inviting me. I'm a little nervous, and I don't know why, because I'm sitting in front of you, and I've known you all your life, so you're like one of my kids, so I shouldn't be nervous, but I've never done anything like this, so hopefully this will help someone, bless someone, or if nothing else, you know, somebody can get encouraged and see that a lot of people may have a different religion or go to a different church, and you may feel inferior or shy about witnessing to them because you know that they already attend the church. And a lot of the times we don't realize that the reason they attend the church, that's where either where they were raised or that's all they know. And even though they might be in a false church or a church that's not teaching the gospel correctly, that sometimes we need to witness to them. Because that's what happened to me. We attended the Catholic Church, and I thought everything was good and fine, but the Lord touched me, and I realized that I wasn't good. So anyway, when Stephen asked me to come on and share my testimony, I started thinking about it, and I decided to go back and maybe share a little bit of my history since a child, just to kind of give you guys an idea where I was born and things, and it may get a little bit boring. So if you listen to this and it gets boring, just fast forward it and we'll try to get through it. But anyway, I was, like Stephen said, I'm from Mexico. I was born in up in a little village up in the mountains. It's called, my children will enjoy this. They always like to ask me where I was born. And I tell them I was born in La Lobera del Tehuel de González Ortega, Zacatecas, and that's in Mexico. It's a little village up in the mountains. No running water, no electricity. I was born in an adobe hut, just a one big room. That was the bedroom, the kitchen, the living room, everything, just one big room. And we lived there till I was about 5 years old. And after 5 years old, Dad decided to move down to Jalisco, where my dad's parents and his some of his siblings had moved down. And so we moved down to Jalisco. And he built us a nice brick house, and we did have electricity, but still no running water. And after Dad finished building the house, him and his brothers had heard from different people that had come to the U.S. and shared their stories on how much money they had made and how great it was, how just money would grow on trees. They never told them the rest of the story that you have to pick the fruit and sell it before you get the money. It does grow on the trees, but you have to pick it and sell it before you get the money. And but anyway, so Dad decided to try it, him and his brothers. So they ventured to go to the U.S. and by the time they got to the U.S. and he got a job and was able to send some money, started sending as much as he could, which still was not enough to support seven children and mom. And so mom began doing laundry for people. We would go pick up their laundry, bring it home, and mom would hand wash and hang dry it and iron it, and then we'd take it back to the people. And me and my brothers would sell candy or gum or popcorn in the streets on the weekends. And we also would help a man that built houses to clear the land, the lots, wherever he was going to build, and help him dig the footings. And which my brothers did most of the work. I did a lot of the playing, but I was still there with them. And so we, Dad would send, like I said, some money as much as he could. And then he would come and visit us whenever he could. And it was always an exciting time anytime he would come because he would bring us little toys or presents from the U.S. And he was always full of stories. So we just thought it was great. But then we always hated that he had to go back. And finally, I was around 8 years old when he came and I told mom that he had just gotten a job. This is in 1975, and he as a machinist building airplane parts, and he started making $14 an hour, which he thought that that was a good income that he could afford to take us with him. So we got excited because we were going to get to go to the U.S. and so that was exciting. He sold the house to one of my uncles. We started selling everything, and we started making plans to go to the U.S. We packed everything up, and of course, you're going to go to the U.S. And at that time, as a child, you would hear the stories, and either from dad or from different people about the U.S. And in your mind, it was just like right now, you think about going to heaven. I mean, it was the most awesome thing you can think of is to go to the U.S. So just us knowing that we're going to get to go, it was so exciting. So of course, if you're going to go to a real special place like that, you want to be dressed the best you can. And so mom had paid this man to tailor make me a suit for my first communion, which is all white. So I thought, I want to wear my suit to go to the U.S. That's my, I was very proud of that suit. So I didn't want to tell mom that I wanted to wear that suit to travel. And so we did. And after we said bye to the family and friends, we walked to the train station, and we rode the train from Jalisco all the way to the border. Which, if my memory serves me right, I think it took us maybe 2 to 3 days. It was a long time. And you can imagine an 8-year-old in a train, eating and sleeping and playing. And if I got tired and I needed to sleep, I would sleep under the seat. So you can imagine an 8-year-old with a white suit, how it would look in. Also, we were not used to our form of transportation was either walking or a horse or a donkey. And me and my sister were being the youngest, we always got the donkey. So we were not used to riding in any kind of vehicle. And so just the motion sickness of riding the train, we threw up a few times. It's just a little miserable. And finally, we made it to the border. And at the border, my dad had already gotten a green card the times he had been back and forth. And he went to apply for us to see if he could get us a green card. And they told him that they could not process the application until we were physically in the U.S. So he had to get us to the U.S., but you don't have a green card, so you have to pay a coyote to go across the border. And, a lot of people think that everybody swims across the river, but actually, my dad paid this couple. They had several children, and they, matched us up the gender and the age as close as they could, and then they to their children, and we crossed pretending like they were our parents. And so they told us if they ask you which school you go to, they told us where we went to school, how old we were, their names, mom and dad's name, our address, just different things. So just in case at the crossing they asked us any questions. And so they would take two at a time, and then once every hour they'd come back and try to go through a different booth so they wouldn't recognize them, and take two more until we all got across. I still remember my n name that was given to me is Juan Angel Delfin Alvarez was my name. I always remembered. It got drilled into my brain so much that I still remember. And finally, when we all got across, Dad was waiting for us at on the other side in another motel in the U.S. And we finally all got across, and my uncle was there in his car waiting for us to take us to L.A. So we loaded up and we started heading out. And again, not used to any vehicles. We just took turns sticking our head out the window and redecorating his car with the stuff that he probably didn't want on the side of his splattered on the side of his car. But we were sick the whole way from the border to LA. And we got to LA. My dad rented an apartment, so we got in and we were so tired. It was late, and we just laid on the in the living room and went to sleep. And the next morning we wake up and dad says, "All right, everybody get in the shower. I got you guys some new clows, so get in the bathrooms you'll see your clothes. Just find your clothes and don't put your dirty clothes so to the side and shower." So when I finished showering, I remember looking around and I got dressed and I think, "Wait, where's my pants?" And so I hollered at dad. I said, "Hey, dad, I can't find any pants." He said, "Oh, no, I didn't buy you pants." He said, "Cause a lot of the little boys your age wear shorts. And so I bought you some shorts. I had never wore a pair of shorts." So I felt like I was walking around in my underwear. So it was very humbling and embarrassing. And then after we all showered and got out, he said, "Okay, now I'm going to take you guys to the park." And, so that was real exciting. And we walked to the park. And the whole time I'm looking around and using my hands to cover my legs. So I just felt like I was, walking around, not fully dressed. And we get to the park and all my brothers and sisters started playing in the swings and running on the grass and this and that. And I went and found the sand pit and dug a hole and buried my legs and sat there because I was too embarrassed to be seen like I was. And so anyway, dad finally rented a house and we started the school. And the first day that I got to school, the bunch of the kids asked me, said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Mexico." And I said, "No, where do you live?" And so I told them where I lived, and immediately I became part of the gang that lived in the neighborhood where we lived. We had not joined, we had not done anything, but just because we lived in the neighborhood, we became part of that gang. And we had to cross three other gangs from our neighborhood to get to school. So that meant we crossed their territory, and that meant we got beat up, we got chased, we got whatever every day going to school and walking back home. So it was pretty miserable. Not what I had pictured in my mind of the U.S. Heavenly place that in my mind was. But regardless, we lived there and began learning the language a little bit. And after about a year being in LA, one night my dad was talking to mom and he told her, he said, "If we stay here, I think I'm gonna lose all my boys, my older brothers." I have two older brothers. One was 4 years and the other one and 5 years older than me. No, 5 and 6 years older than me. And so they were in middle school already, and they began wearing the baggy pants and the bandanas and just to fit in with the other boys. And since they were part of the gang, they had to, dress the just like them. And my dad told my mom, he said, "If we stay here, I think I'm gonna lose my boys." So just I don't know, where it seems like at 3 in the morning, they wake us up and they threw a trash bag for each one of us. And they told us, "Whatever you can fit in that trash bag in an hour, we're leaving." And like, "Whoa, where are we going?" And mom had a brother that lived here in the valley. And so he said, "We're going to go see your uncle." And so we got excited. We're going somewhere, So we threw whatever we could in the bag and we loaded up in the station wagon and here we come, And, we got to the address that mom had of her brother. It was a Raisin City address, but the address said Carruthers. So we finally asked enough people that they directed us to Carruthers. Once we found Carruthers, we asked them, "Where's this address?" And the address was on Bryan Avenue, which is, Brian doesn't run through Carruthers. It's in more towards Raisin City. And so then they would send us to Raging City, and then we'd get to Raging City, and we said, there was, you know, what are you looking for? I said, we're looking for Carruthers and this address. Well, they send us back to Carruthers. So we spent all day long back and forth from Carruthers. I still remember Henderson. We would pass at that time on Henderson, and I think it's Nebraska. It used to be a little crop dusting little airport. And so we would see those little airplanes, and I thought, we've seen these airplanes all day long, Dad. And we were going to the same, just back and forth from Carruthers to Raging City. Finally, it got late, and Dad said, let's just, you know, go to sleep, and tomorrow morning we'll try it again. And we just parked on Dinuba, east of Hayes, just in front of a house. And so we just went to sleep, everybody in the car. And in the morning, the owner gets up, and it just so happened that she was the Spanish teacher from the Carruthers High School, Mrs. Lowe. We had parked in front of her house. So she goes to see what's going on, who's parked in front of my house. And, so my dad explained what was going on, and she told him, said, I have about 15 minutes that I can spare, but I think I can find this address, but, I can't, you know, come back and then take you to it. So what if I take two of your children and they can, you know, I'll tell them where it's at, and then I'll drop them off, and then they can take you. So they said, sure. And so she took Ephraim and Loopy, and in about 10, 15 minutes, they come back, and they found the house. So we went and found my uncle in Raising City, you know, and out of all the places in the U.S. to end up in is, you know, Raising City. And the reason I started sharing a lot of this history, I began thinking back and realized that the Lord had his hand in a lot of ways in my life, and the decisions that Dad made in the location that we ended up. So this is part of the reason that I decided to share part of this story. So anyway, we get to my uncle's place, and of course he lives in a house that the farmer has supplied for him and like five other guys, single guys. And so it doesn't look good for a family, you know, to be there. So he took us to the farmer's house and explained who we were, and the farmer says, yeah, I can use some help. So he told Dad, yeah, I'll hire you, I'll give you a job. And he had another house in Carruthers that only one old man lived in. So he said, I'm gonna you know, put you guys there until I can figure something out. So we lived with that old man for a few months, and then he kicked out all the men from the house in Raising City and moved them out and put them in with that old man and gave us the house by ourselves, a two-story house. So that was neat. So anyway, like I said earlier, Dad had gotten that job in L.A. As a machinist, building airplane parts, making $14 an hour. Now we're in Raising City, and it's in the wintertime that there's not a lot of work. And so he began pruning grapes for that farmer. And at that time, minimum wage was $2.90. So that was a big wage cut, and, you know, with seven children. And so we just did the best we could with, you know, what Dad would bring in. And a few months after we got here, all of a sudden we get a visit from my uncles from L.A. They work with my dad in L.A. And we thought they were just coming to visit to see us. And it wasn't until a few years ago that I went to one of my uncle's funerals that my other uncle shared. And he told me, he said, remember we used to go see you guys when you guys first moved? And I said, yeah. He said, the reason we were going is our boss would send us and would tell us, go tell your brother, I'll give him $18 if you'll return. And my dad would tell him, he said, my family's worth more than money. And so Dad made a big sacrifice for us. Moving from LA from a good paying job to going to the farm, to going to the country and working in the fields. You know, working in the fields is not the easiest work, you know, compared to where he came from in the factory and machine as a machinist. And, so I've always been very thankful for that decision that Dad made and that stance that he took that his family was worth more than money. And, like I said, he began working, and when the summer came, then there was a little more work that we could do and help So we would pick grapes, pick tomatoes, pick the whole cotton. There was a small farmer on Brian in Floral, I believe. He had 10 acres, and that year that we got here, he decided to plant cotton, but he was too small of a farmer to own or be able to rent a cotton picker. So we were the cotton pickers. So I've heard stories of a lot of the older people that came from Oklahoma and Arkansas and stuff and tell the stories about them picking cotton. So I did get a little experience that one year picking cotton by hand. It was just miserable. It was big old long sacks. They were it would take forever. It seemed like to fill them up, and then after they get full, just dragging them to emptying them out. And when you're picking the cotton, just poking your fingers on the little dried up bloom that where the cotton is. And so we tried helping Dad in the summer and our Christmas breaks, working in the fields. And so he taught us to work hard. And after a while, we began, you know, getting older and able to do more, and begin to help a little more around the house with more income. And after a while, my sisters got a job at Beast Market, working at the grocery store. And after two of my sisters and then one of my brothers worked there for a while. And then my older sister got another job and she quit. And then my brother got another job and he quit. And so then the owner asked my sister, said, "Don't you have another brother that, you know, might work?" And I said, "Well, he's only 13. He said, "That's okay. I don't care." He said, "You guys are hard workers, you know." So I began working at Beast Market in the afternoons. I would work in the fields in the morning and then help him the afternoons at the store. And after the summer was over, he told me that he liked, you know, he would like for me to continue working for him. So that was neat that I didn't have to work in the field as much. And so I began working at Beast Market. And my brother, Renee, he got a job at a dairy. And he would take care of feeding the cows, driving the tractors, and taking care of the cows that way. And the milkers began complaining about their wages and they wanted more money. And one of them told them that we should just get the union. And if we get the union, then we can make more money. And so he talked them into getting the farm workers union involved in and see if they could get the union at the dairy. And there was none of the men knew how to speak English except for one man. And so the day came that they were going to have the election, see if the union would go in or not. And that man that could speak English didn't show up purposely. And so they went and got my brother. And he had nothing to do with the union, nothing to do with the milkers, but they knew he spoke English. And they said, "Hey, this other guy didn't show up, and we're not going to know what to do. Can you come and just help us and translate for us?" And so he said, "Sure." And later his friends told me that while they were waiting for the voting to start, he got an extension cord and strung it out in the yard and got a TV, and they were watching cartoons. He said he was making us laugh translating the cartoons for us. He said and my brother was always just a lighthearted kind of guy, just a very people person. I was always the shy one, not him. And I looked up to him a lot. Both of my brothers were, one is 5 years and the other one's 6 years older than me. Ephraim is the oldest. He was also shy and quiet, but he liked fast cars. So I was like hanging around him and, you know, while he's working on his cars. And Renee also liked fast cars, and they both liked working out. So I would always hang out with them, and they always take me with wherever they went. So both of them were kind of like my heroes. And Renee started working there. And so the day that they were going to vote, the farmer, the dairy owner, did not want the union to go And so he called his brother-in-law and said, bring all your workers from your dairy and we're going to pretend that they work for me so they can vote against the union. And then he said, and then also bring, he called him his pistoletto, which would be his gunman. He said, and just have him scare the guy that speaks English. It's because if he scares him off, then nobody else will know what to do. But this guy did not know who the guy that spoke English was or not, which they were thinking about the other guy. But that day, that guy did not show up. And I don't know if he got wind of it, if that's why he didn't show up or what, but my brother instead was there. And while they were, he was making the other guys laugh with the cartoons, the brother-in-law and the gunman pulled up. And later it was told that all he was supposed to do, it just called them. They didn't know who it was. So they said, we just speak to in English and whoever comes, just show him a gun and tell him to get out and just scare him. And so when they pulled up, they hollered out in English and my brother came to the car and he said, yeah, can I help you? And as soon as he said his friend went with him. And his friend told me, he said, when he bent over the car window and asked him, yeah, can I help you? The gunman was in the passenger seat and he pulled out the gun that he was only supposed to show him, but he was drugged up and drunk and he pulled it and shot my brother in the head. And his friend said he immediately fell and the car took off and I was working at Beast Market, when that happened, and Kenny Cox came, Kenny Cox, a senior, came to the store and he said, hey, something's going on at the dairy where your brother's working. And I said, and I saw his motorcycle on the ground. So you may want to go check on him. So I called Dad right away, and Dad went and checked on it. By that time, the ambulance was there and had taken him. And a little bit after that, my dad came to the store crying and he said, they shot your brother. And he said, I think he's dead, but we're not sure. And so that was a horrible time in our life. We went to the hospital and they told us that he was brain dead, that he was just on life support. And Dad asked them for a second opinion. They called another doctor and they tested him and they said, no, I'm sorry, but you know, that's he's just on life support, but there's no chance. And so we had to make the decision to unplug him. And as soon as they unplugged him, of course, he passed away. And took a big, turn of events for me as seeing my brother that I looked up to being gone, and then the man that did it, I began just a hatred for the man that shot him and for the man that for the brother-in-law of the dairy owner. And this was in 1983, and I carry that load, and I began at the viewing. I was at the front of the church, and people would come by and tell you they were sorry for our loss. And I was in the front, and I had my face covered as a child, just a machismo thing that, boys don't cry. So I was crying, but I didn't want people to see me cry. So I would cover my face and look down and cover my face, and I didn't greet anybody. And finally, this school friends showed up. They came to me and whispered in my ear who they were, and I just nodded my head. And they told me, they said, if you're thinking of taking revenge, just let us know and we'll help you. And I knew what they meant. Not too long before that, they had killed a man. And they got away with it. It was a dad and I think it was like five brothers and one girl. But they were just I knew what they meant, so I thought, well, great. Now I can, I have somebody to help me, you know, take revenge on my brother's death. And so the devil began building that hatred. And then I would catch myself, and I thought, no, the authorities will take care of it. I just need to leave it alone. But I couldn't get rid of the hatred. And I knew I was, if I went through with what I was thinking, that I was going to end up either getting killed myself or end up in prison. And I would try to talk myself into just forgetting about it, but I couldn't. And that hatred began to build to the extent that I thought, what good is it going to do for me to kill those men? And, you know, they're not going to know why I killed them. So now the devil kept putting thoughts in my mind, you know, if you catch them and kidnap them in some way and then torture them, and then, you know, tell them why you're going to kill them, then kill them. And all these random thoughts would come to my mind about, you know, how to do it and what I was going to do. And it was never in my mind if I was or not, but just when the right time would be. And like I said, I was still working at Beast Market. And I would wake up in the morning, and that usually would be my first thought about that hatred. And I would go to bed, and it usually would be my last thought. And I was working at Beast Market, and the summer was going to come, and we always got real busy. So the boss, Rick Nelson, came to me and said, we need to hire somebody else for the summer. And he said, I put out an ad, and we need another young boy to help us. And he said, I've gotten all these applications. He had a handful of applications. And he said, I want you to go through them. And you know these boys. I don't know them. And you'll know who to pick since you're going to train them. And I said, okay. So I went through the applications and ended up with a boy, Butch Heppner, and Marvin Oakley. And I came to the boss and I told him, I said, either one of these boys will be good. I said, both of them are strong. Both of them are hard workers. I said, there's only one problem with this one boy. I said, Marvin Oakley used to be just rough, one of the roughest kids in town. Everybody was scared of him in school. And he was on drugs. He was just not a good person. But they had a revival, and he got saved. I didn't know what salvation was. I just know that something happened. This boy has changed. You know, that there was an obvious change. I didn't understand it, but, and so I told my boss, I said, there's only one problem with this boy. I said, he's real religious. And he just laughed and he looked at me and he says, well, you're going to train him. So you pick. If you're saying that either one of these boys will be good, so you pick them. And I remember looking at those papers and going back and forth, which one, and I finally picked Marvin. And, it wasn't just the first day after he started working. I thought, man, I made a mistake. I should have picked the other boy. This guy, all he wants to talk about is Jesus in church. And all day long. And he was a great guy, but it's just all day long he wanted to talk about Jesus. And so I thought, well, I guess, you know, as long as he works hard. And November comes along, and the Raising City Holiness Church was having a revival with Brother Joe Sosa. And he comes to me and he says, hey, the church, the Holiness Church is having a revival and I want to go after work. Would you go with me? And I said, no, I don't really want to go. He said, come on, man. I just don't want to walk in. We're going to be a little bit late, but I don't want to walk in by myself. And this guy's a Mexican and he's a real good preacher and I really want to hear him. I think he'll enjoy him. Come on. And he just begged and begged. And finally I said, all right, I'll go with you. So we go to church. And this is my first experience ever being in another church other than a Catholic church. And so it was different. The songs were very upbeat. People were a little more lively. The Catholic church is very boring and stale, I guess. Same thing every service. And so it was different, but I was kind of enjoying it, a little different. And then the preacher gets up. And he begins to preach, and he starts screaming and starts just preaching like most holiness preachers do. And he began preaching on hell. And I remember feeling something inside that I had never felt. And as he was preaching, and now I know it was conviction, but I didn't understand it. But I was very scared, kind of. And all of a sudden, Marvin turns to me and said, "Oh, I forgot I had to do this or that. And so we have to go." So it was right. He wasn't quite finished preaching, but we left. So we didn't stay for altar service. So when I walked out, I was almost like, you know, whatever that feeling was like. And I was glad that I was out. And so we went home and we kept going. And this was November. And come January, at that time, the church had their camp meeting in January. So comes January, it's camp meeting time. And Marvin starts up again. He said, "Oh, the Holiness Church is having their camp meeting, and I want to go to the night service. Why don't you go with me?" I said, "No." He said, "Oh man, there's people from all over the U.S., from Oklahoma, from Arkansas, from different places. There's a lot of people." I mean, and I told him, I said, "Oh, it's even worse." I said, "I hate crowds." I said, "I don't want to go." And he said, "Come on, man, I don't want to go by myself. We're gonna be a little bit late too." And I went, "Come on, just go with me." And I kept saying no. And finally he said, "Come on, man, there's a bunch of pretty girls." Well, the store is real close to the church. So I had seen between the services that the young people would come and buy candy at the store. And so I noticed that when the young people would come, the young girls stood out more than anything because of their long hair and their dress. And it reminded me of the girls in Mexico. I mean, when we left Mexico, most of the girls and ladies wore their dresses. Most of them never cut their hair. Even in the Catholic Church, the priest would not allow the girls or ladies to walk in without their head being covered. He would send them back out, and they would have to get their husband's handkerchief or a little baby's diaper or whatever they could to cover their hair before they can come back in church. And I remember my uncle, the first time that my aunt decided to put a pair of pants, he chased her with a little branch and hit in her legs till she went back inside and changed back to her dress. So it brought, a piece of Mexico back to me when I saw that many young girls and ladies with their long hair and their dresses. That when he said, "There's a bunch of pretty girls." Well, I had already seen them. I thought, well, okay, I'll go check out the girls. And so I went with that intent. And, I said that I was raised Catholic. And when we moved to Jalisco, when we lived up in the mountains, we didn't hardly go to church because there was no church. And the priest would only come up maybe once or twice a year for a special service. And we would have a church in the schoolhouse. And but when we moved to Jalisco, there's a church about a mile or two away, and we'd walk to it. We were very faithful, and we did everything that was required by the church to be considered a good Catholic. So we're very devout, very faithful to church. And so when I went to church with Marvin, when he would witness to me, I would always tell him, I said, "I'm a nice person. I'm a good person." I said, "I don't need whatever you have." I said, "I'm happy with what I have." I said, "I don't drink. I don't do drugs." My brother was a big instrument. My two older brothers were a big instrument of me, not drinking or using drugs. When some of my friends began doing it, my brother, Renee, especially, his friends would invite him to a party. And he would always, they say, "Hey, you want to go to the party?" And he said, "Oh, cake and ice cream?" And he says, "No, man, we're going to drink and we're going to smoke and we're going to do this and that." Like, "Oh, man, if there's no cake and ice cream, that's not a party." And he would just make fun of him. And I would hear him yell like that. And I thought, wow, you know. And so it was never a temptation. A police officer came, I think when I was sixth or seventh grade, and told us the dangers of drugs and the different, the alcohol. And at that time, I loved playing soccer, played a lot of sports. And so I was trying to get faster and better at the sports that I was playing. So I thought, why would I put something in my system that's going to damage that? So there was never a temptation to drink or do drugs or smoke. And so when Marvin would try to witness to me and tell me that I needed to change, I thought, well, I'm fine. I'm not doing anything wrong. I felt like I was going to heaven because I had been baptized. I had been confirmed. I had done my first communion. I had been, going to catechism and done everything. And the Catholics, they teach that if you do those things, I mean, you have you go to heaven. And so I was not going for any spiritual help. I was just going because I wouldn't, he asked me to go and I was going to go look at the girls. And so when I went there, of course, the service was different. A lot of people, it made me more nervous. We were towards the back and they sang and they testified. And finally, it's time for the preacher to preach. And Brother John Lee was the preacher that night. And he began preaching on hell again. And this is my second time in a homeless church. And both times it was on hell. And I felt conviction so strong. And the Lord had blessed Brother John Lee to reach for sinners. And I could, when he would invite someone to come to the altar, I almost felt like he was pulling at my heart that I wanted to go. But yet I would look around and see so many people. And I thought, there's no way I'm going up to the front. And the conviction was so strong. And I thought, there's no way I would keep talking myself out of it. And finally, Sister Bonnie walks to the back and taps me on the arm and asks me, said, would you like to go pray? And without thinking, I said, sure. And then she just kind of led me to the front. And as I'm walking to the front, I'm thinking like, oh my goodness, what did I do? I should have said no. But then I couldn't, take my word back and out of respect for her. And so I kept walking through the front and finally she got me to the altar and all the men surrounded me. And I knelt down and I was nervous. I was just there trying to figure out what I did. And I kept hearing the men, they started beating me on the back and tell me to pray. And I think like, why are they beating me on the back? And they kept screaming, you pray and all of these things, but praying was the biggest thing that I could remember hearing. They were saying the other things, and so I thought, well, I guess I have to pray if not they're going to keep beating on me. And, being Catholic, I began praying to Mary and began reciting all my Catholic prayers that I had memorized as a little boy. They said, pray. And that's all I knew what to do. And, finally, Brother Terry Guthrie was a pastor then, and he got close enough to my ear and he began explaining the plan of salvation. And, it made so much sense. And all of a sudden, when I walked in the church feeling like, that I didn't need any spiritual help, that I felt fine, all of a sudden I felt like a sinner. I felt dirty. I felt unclean. When he explained the plan of salvation and told me that I needed to repent of my sins and confess them with my mouth and believe in my heart, and I started thinking of the things that I had done. And like I said, I hadn't done, drunk or done drugs or something, but there was other things that I had done that I knew that were not right. At that time, I started a college. I was going to college. And even though I was strong to say no to the drugs and to the other things, the devil was putting other temptations and other sins that would have destroyed my life in a different way. That was not with the drugs and not with the drinking. And I began thinking of all those temptations, all those things that the devil was placing in front of me and the things that I had done. And I didn't feel very, all of a sudden, I didn't feel very proud of who I was. All of a sudden I came aware that I was not as good as I thought. And the phrase that I kept hearing is confess, confess. Well, that's the thing that I hated to do the most, that when we went to the Catholic Church, you would go in and on Saturdays, you would go to the church and confess to the priest, and you would be in one little room and there was a little curtain that you could not see him, but he could see you, and you would confess to him. It depends on how many sins you confessed,
then he would make you pray that many prayers. And then you'd have to, you would walk out and then have to go pray that many before you can leave. And it, once you did that, then on Sunday you could partake of the communion. And so I always hated it. So I always lied to him instead. So I wouldn't, make up a few little small sins so I could, I don't have to pray that much. So I didn't like confessing. And when the preacher kept telling me to confess, all these sins came to mind. And I thought, well, I'm not real proud of him, and I don't know that I want all these people to know what I've done. And so then I remembered I'm in an American church with mostly English-speaking people, and so I began repenting in Spanish so nobody would understand. And I remember very sincerely asking the Lord to forgive me and naming the sins. And when I finished, I remember telling the Lord, Lord, if I've forgotten anything, please forgive me. And all of a sudden I felt something that I couldn't explain. I had never felt it before, but I felt like I was finished. And I remember raising up from praying and looking up, and there's this bunch of men all around me. And they knew what had happened, but I didn't know. And they were all smiling at me, like, why are these men smiling so big at me? And they began hugging me and patting me on the back. And I think, like, what's going on? And so this, you know, we went back to our seat, and the service was dismissed. The young people asked me to go out with them. And so I went, had a good time with them, and got back home and just went to bed. I was tired. And didn't even think nothing of it. I was still processing everything that happened. I had a great time after church and processing what had happened during church. Went to sleep. The next morning I wake up, and that's when it hit me that hatred for that man that had killed my brother was gone. That would be usually my first thought every morning. And when I woke up and I realized that the hatred was gone, I knew that something had happened. Even though I didn't understand it, I knew, I said, I have to go back. I said, something happened. I'm not understanding. So they were still having camp meetings. So I went for the rest of the camp meeting. And that's when I realized that the Lord had changed me and cleansed me. I began, going to church, but at the same time, after the Lord did that work for me, all of a sudden the devil began putting thoughts in my mind that in the Catholic Church, they teach if you change religions, that you're sinning. And I remember praying and asking the Lord, Lord, if I, by coming to this church, if I'm committing a sin, then I don't want to come. And so I started getting very confused. I was liking and enjoying what I was feeling and the church, the singing and the preaching, but yet this confusion that I may be sinning. And Brother Terry gave me a Bible. And so I would have a question in my mind, and Brother Terry would preach, and with the Bible, he would answer my question. And I'd go to look at that scripture, and I thought, like, wow, you know, that's what I was just thinking. And little by little, it kept happening either with a testimony or with a preaching that the Lord began to show me in the Bible there's a lot of the teachings in the Catholic Church. They have a lot of good teachings, but they also have a lot of teachings that don't go along with the Bible. And when I saw those, I thought, wow. And I still wasn't 100% convinced that this, I was still going, but yet still wondering. And my mom went to see my grandma in Mexico. And when she came back, she said, when I got there, your grandma is losing her mind a little bit. And the children got her Bible and were tearing it up. So I took it from them, and I brought it with me. And since you're the only one that reads the Bible, I wondered if you wanted it. It was a Catholic Bible. I said, sure. So I took it. And earlier I mentioned about you living up in the mountains, and we didn't go to church a lot because there was no church and the priest would only come a few times. Somehow my grandma ended up with a Bible, which that's a real rarity for a Catholic to read their Bible. But my grandma, mom's mom, in the evenings when it started getting dark, she would light up a bunch of those kerosene lanterns, and were homemade lanterns. And we would sit around and she would read us the Bible. And we didn't get as indoctrinated as we did once we moved to Jalisco. But anyway, it was that Bible that mom brought me. And I thought, oh, now I get to have a Catholic Bible and find those scriptures that they were preaching on, where I found that it was contradicting the Catholic religion. I said, I wonder what their Bible says. And that was identical. I went to John 3:16. I went to the Ten Commandments. I went to several scriptures that let me know these teachings are in their Bible and they're not following them. And so that kind of gave me okay. And it took, like I said, a while. And finally, I remember telling the Lord, I said, I think I'm in the right place. And just... the Lord's been good. I mean, I've observed him since then, and he's just done a lot of great things for me. I think this is the best thing I ever did, or that he ever did for me. And I remember right after I got saved, right after I started going to church there, my oldest sister went to mom, and she said, Mom, when are you going to tell Paco to... quit going to that church. My name is Juan Francisco. So for the Francisco part of it, they call me Paco at home. And she said, when are you going to tell Paco to quit going to that church? He's a Catholic. And my mom's response was, ever since he started going to that church, he said, I don't have to worry about him, where he's going, where he's going to be. And he has made such so many changes for the good. He said, I'm not about to stop him from going to that church. So mom could see the difference and the change that even though we were so-called Catholics, mom liked the results of what she was seeing. And the Lord has just been good to me all these years. It's blessed me in a lot of ways. Blessed me with a beautiful wife and blessed me with 8 children and, just a lot of blessings that have come from that decision. And, going back, I can see how the Lord had his hand on the decisions that Dad made for us as a family, just how he directed us to Raising City. There's not a lot of holiness churches in California. And thinking of coming from L.A. to the farm community, I mean, you can start from Bakersfield all the way to, a lot of places that my uncle could have settled down in, but he ended up in Raising City, and that's where we came, and the Lord led us here, and I think because of that I was able to find the Lord and serve him in a holiness church. So I think it's just been a blessing for me and my family now.
Okay, I guess I'll have to stop there and just have you back at another time.
All right. Well, yeah, thanks for having me.
I was thinking about having you tell one or two other stories, but it is late and you don't tell short stories.
No.
So we're going to have to cut it there. Thank you all for listening.